Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, today we're going to get right back into the key highlights of the history leading to the printing of the Authorized King James Bible. Now, the last time I talked to you about, we're going to get into the 1300s. But I just wanted to just mention quickly this whole idea of the controversy over everyone being able to have the Bible. And I just wanted to just let you know quickly, you could read this in Gerald Flory's book, The True History of the True Church, of God's True Church, I think it is. It's The True History of God's True Church. If you look in there, we do talk a lot about Peter Waldo. And it was Peter Waldo that actually, he was a wealthy merchant at one time, and he did leave that profession, gave up a lot of his money. But it was his idea, and he did work in France, but it was his idea to make sure that everyone could read the Bible in their own language. And he was one of the first ones to begin this idea of translating into the vernacular or translating into the language of the common people. His first translation was in a dialect of French or the French language. So, I'm going to skip ahead now a few years again. If you really want to read some details about this, you can, go into the true history of God's True Church, and it covers it in much more detail. But if you look at, there was this growing influence by Waldo's group, and you can even read in secular sources like Derek Wilson's book, The People's Bible, and it just shows how the Catholic Church was really working against Peter Waldo's group. His group was growing in influence, and certainly the reason why it was growing influence is because people were able to read the Bible, and people began to see, well, that the Catholic Church was not even teaching from the Bible. And so at this, at the Fourth Lateran Council, the Pope wanted no Bible reading outside the priesthood. And I think I said to you in the last program, that's how I was taught as a young Catholic boy. I was very interested in reading the Bible, and I was told, well, only the priest can read the Bible, and by the way, it'll drive you crazy or make you crazy if you read it. So the Catholic Church was really wielding quite a bit of power. But again, these two ministers moved into England, and they were, from Europe. They we'll talk a little bit more about them in just a second. But it is interesting when you first look at England, and especially Catholic England, it was the only European country to actually ban Bible translation. Now, it is amazing how this history changed, and it changed rather quickly. And this happened in the very early 1300s. And remember now that to escape extinction, the tiny church or the God's church had to go into hiding, and they went into the Piedmont Valley in northwest Italy. But then it was around the midway through the 14th century. Now, I'm talking about 14th century England. And remember, 14th century England was still very Catholic, dominated by the Catholic Church. Remember that the Church of God was still moving west, and these two ministers moved into England. And it was also interesting at that time, let's say midway through this 14th century, or that would be the 1300s, there was a lot of disaffection growing in England about the high taxation of the church. And of course, the English nobility was against that. And it's at this time then, the break between England and the Catholic Church began to develop. Now, it was also at this time that English education began to develop. And there was these great institutions such as Oxford and Cambridge, well-educated men. You know, they began to study. They got away from, let's say, these worn-out, centuries-old Catholic feudal, you know, thinking and feudal society. And so essentially, at the university level, I mean, these universities were actually religious schools, and they began to train theologians, and these theologians became expert in Greek, reading Greek, studying Greek, speaking Greek. They became experts in Hebrew and as well as Latin. And essentially what happened is the knowledge of the Bible grew rapidly since the study of the scriptures became part of university curriculum. And so one thing that these scholars uncovered was Catholic doctrine did not square with the Bible. And so we're going to focus now a little bit more on secular history and not necessarily the history from the Bible. We can now, we have a lot of secular record. That first century of the church, we don't have much record, and we have to have the Bible to have the history of what happened there. Now, there was a leading academic at this time, and his name was John Wycliffe. Now, John Wycliffe was not a member of God's true church, but he began to publicly attack the corruption of the Catholic clergy. Excuse me. Now, Wycliffe was a priest. Wycliffe was well-educated in math, natural science, and ecclesiastical law, but he had a passion to know the Bible. And essentially what he did is he made the Bible the focus of his graduate work. So by 1377, Wycliffe was known for giving these stirring lectures, and you could say sermons as well, and it was really popular among the nobles and the common people. He was a gifted speaker. He had a brilliant and inquiring mind. And essentially, he was able to clearly debate what he was learning from the scripture. And so this really, turned the Catholic elite to be his number one enemy. Now remember, the Catholic Church at this time was still dominant in England. Now, his knowledge of the scripture and his popularity put him in constant danger of execution. And, he was not a member of the church, but he was going against certainly religious authority. And a lot of the bishops, they were in both the clergy and in the government. And so the government could turn against anyone and execute them. Now, Wycliffe was spared execution in 1378. And the reason why, and he was really on his way to execution, but the reason why is the Catholic Church really actually slit its own throat at that time with the Great Schism. Now, that's another part of history, and I'll let you study into that yourself. But there were three popes vying for power. Now, there's supposed to be one pope at a time. Well, there were three different men. All three of them were saying they were the pope. And so for a while, the church's credibility was destroyed, and men began to look elsewhere for leadership in England. And John Wycliffe actually was very willing to step into the spotlight. Now, what he did is he really went after the church. He constantly showed that the Catholic Church was in conflict with Christianity's foundational document, the Bible. It was about the Bible. And what Wycliffe wanted to do is he actually wanted to remove papal control of the scripture. And it was, in some ways, he wanted to follow what Peter Waldo had done. He wanted to take the Bible and have it translated into the English language. Now, this really was, even for our world, this was a momentous event in the history of the Bible. So in 1380, Wycliffe and a group of scholars began to translate the Latin Bible into English. Now, at that time, Wycliffe did have the full protection of the English nobility in Parliament. And so he was able to produce many tracts that exposed the unbiblical teachings of the Catholic Church, and he showed a lot about where the clergy was corrupt in their practices. Here's a quote from what he wrote at that time. He says, "All Christians and lay lords in particular ought to know Holy Writ and defend it." And he proclaimed the right to make the Bible available for everyone. Now, the thing that happened was really kind of disastrous. In 1381, there was a peasants' revolt in England. In Rome, they found a way to blame Wycliffe for it. And what they said is, Wycliffe's open challenge of spiritual authority was the reason for the breakdown of law and order in England. Now, I'm sure there were many other things that were, factors in that peasants' revolt. But anyway, he was actually called for execution again, but the nobles wouldn't let anybody touch him. And so what Wycliffe did, he actually left Oxford, but he didn't stop his work. And actually during the last few years of his life, he was able to get the Bible into the hands of preachers who could spread the scriptures to other common people. Now, it was around the same time, if you remember, just as we started this program, I talked about two ministers moving from the Church of God into England. And historians call Wycliffe's movement the Lollards. The thing that we need to know, and again, this is why the true history of God's true church is so important. We know that the Lollards, had been in existence long before Wycliffe, and it was Walter and Raymond Lollard. And, of course, they were brothers, but they were also true ministers of Jesus Christ. They had moved into England around 1315. Now, they moved right out of the Waldensian strongholds that, had been heavily persecuted. So we know they kept moving west, as I said. They were fleeing persecution. Now, it says, if you look in the history books, it says that we're not sure what their last names were. It's unlikely that they were Walter and Raymond Lollard. It's more like that was probably an epithet. In the Netherlands, the Waldensians were called Lollards, and it was that's a Flemish word meaning lollen or lollen, and it's to speak softly or mumble. And if you read the true history of God's true church, you'll see that at that time people were memorizing sections of the Bible because it was illegal to have a copy of it. So it's more likely that the ministers just took advantage of the fact that they could, pass the Bible around. And Walter and Raymond were known for that, for getting copies of the English Bible out through England. Now, it is interesting to note that even Wycliffe and his associates, like I said, we know they weren't in the Church of God, but they were also declared heretics. And, unfortunately, many of his followers were murdered. But really, it's amazing. We shouldn't forget what they accomplished. Now, it's kind of also interesting, I think, that Wycliffe himself escaped martyrdom when he died of a stroke in 1384. But something really weird happened. In 1428, a group of Catholic clergy dug up Wycliffe's bones, and they burned them, and they tossed his ashes into a nearby stream. And that was their effort to stop the movement for Bibles in the vernacular, Bibles, in the common language. Now, obviously that effort failed. Now, let's skip ahead now to the 1500s. Remember, even at this time, the Catholic religion is still the dominant religion, even in England. But the 1500s saw the birth of the Renaissance. Now, essentially, the Renaissance was the removal of the dark mental oppression that the Catholic clergy had put on the people in Europe, and there was this whole new burst of interest in education, in art, literature, math, and science. In 1450, the printing press came into being. It made all these educational materials readily available for the public as a whole. And we know that the first book published by the printing press inventor Johann Gutenberg was the Latin language Bible. And you can still see copies of that Bible today in the National Library in London. But it's interesting. The Bible was actually the hottest selling item in Europe at that time. And even I brought out in the last program, or the last maybe two programs ago, is the Bible is still the hottest best-selling item today even though a lot of people won't admit it. Now, it's kind of interesting. The Catholic Church made the Bible forbidden, but essentially it made it even more popular. You know, if you have something forbidden, people seem to want it more. So now, let's skip ahead to the 16th century. There was Erasmus, and Erasmus was a Dutch scholar. And, you know, he was kind of an international celebrity at the time. He's considered one of the founding fathers of the Renaissance. He's best known for his book that he wrote in 1508 called In Praise of Folly, and it was a satire on the society at that time. But again, he did not, in this book, in his Praise of Folly, he did not spare the practices of the church and the clergy. And, you know, he really went after them. But Erasmus was really knowledgeable in Greek. And he was also lecturing at Cambridge at the time. And what he did is he wanted to update the Latin version of the New Testament. And so what he did is he went back to the earliest, best Greek text he could find. And he wanted to make a perfect Latin text that was better than the Latin Vulgate. Now, the Latin Vulgate was obviously the baby of the Catholic Church. Now, he also, you know, joined in with some of the other, let's say, people that wanted to rebel against Catholic authority. And so he wanted this New Testament to help cleanse the Catholic Church of its error. Now, what he did, and this I just want to bring this out, is he greatly disturbed Catholic authorities because he edited out of the his translation the Vulgate's heretical edition of the Trinity, and you can find that in 1 John 5, verses 7 and 8. Now, that is in the New King James Bible, not in the New King James Bible, but it is in the King James Bible. But you cannot find that in the earliest Greek text. And it is a direct reference to the Trinity, which is a doctrine that is not really in the Bible. And it was just added. Okay, we can skip ahead to Martin Luther. And, of course, we know what Martin Luther did. He was on the theology faculty at Wittenberg. He began to speak out against papal indulgences. You know, and that's where you really it really kind of takes you back to Simon Magus. You know, Simon Magus wanted to buy an office. Well, with papal indulgences, you could buy yourself out of purgatory or hell if you gave enough money to the Pope. So it was just, you know, part of that whole practice of simony. Now, what Luther did is he invited scholars all across Europe to join him in the study of the Bible and what it had to say about the church corruption. Of course, he was not a popular figure in Rome. Now, essentially what Martin Luther did is he produced a German-language Pentateuch, and that's the first five books of the Bible in 523, and then he produced a German-language New Testament in 1529. And so the thing is what this whole history just shows you how more and more people wanted the Bible to be accessed by the common people. They wanted it in their own language. Now, Luther's books were eventually banned at Cambridge. Remember, Cambridge was really a religious university, just like Oxford. And, you know, the Catholic Church was still dominating in England. But essentially, when Luther's books were banned, there was another student there. His name was William Tyndall. Now, Tyndall was also a priest. He was a theologian. He was a gifted linguist. What he did is he fled from that university, and he liked what Luther was doing. And what Tyndall then intended to do is he wanted to translate the Bible into English from all the fresh sources following in the tradition of Erasmus. In other words, he wanted to get to the purest text he could. Now, he was denied approval by the English Catholic Church authorities, but he didn't give up. He found financial support for his project through a well-known Lollard named Humphrey Monmouth. Now, he was a wealthy cloth merchant, and he provided him food and shelter. Now, I don't know if we could say if this man was a member of God's church or not, but he sounds very similar to Peter Waldo. Now, word spread absolutely rapidly that Tyndall was a translation genius. He was proficient in about 8 languages, and even though he used Erasmus's Greek New Testament as a foundation for his translation, his was totally original. It was so clear, and it was so easy to read in English, people could understand it. He really did have this gift for transmitting the original meaning from one language to another. Really, much of Tyndale's New Testament translation still appears as originally written in the King James Bible. Now, obviously, to complete his work, he had to go into hiding. His life was in constant danger. In 1526, Tyndale's New Testament was finally printed in Worms, Germany. It was smuggled into England. And then this text, once it was in the hands of the people, it became a sensation. And Tyndale produced corrected versions of his New Testament and began working on the Old Testament. Now, authorities in England couldn't short-circuit the demand for Tyndale's work. What they did was they resorted to buying copies simply to burn them. And the battle over the Bible became very bloody. Many, including Tyndale, who was actually betrayed by a friend, they lost their lives fighting for the right to have the Bible in their own native language. Tyndale was never able to finish the Old Testament, but he did do such an excellent job on the New Testament. Now, the ban against Tyndale's book was so thorough, there's only 3 copies left. And one is in the British National Library, and I have actually seen that. So it's really exciting. Okay, now let's skip ahead to Henry VIII and to James VI. Now, if we look at Henry VIII, he's considered part of many people might consider him part of the Protestant Reformation that was fomenting in Europe, but actually, all Henry was really after was getting out of his marriage so he could produce a legal heir to the throne. He did win his fight with Rome. He established the English church. But essentially, by 1530, he realized that there was so much foment in his country. There was Protestants against Catholics. There was Bible readers against non-Bible readers. I mean, the country was really like at civil war. And so what Henry VIII did is people couldn't stop the spread of Tyndale's translation. Remember, Henry VIII, even though he split with the Catholic Church, he still considered himself a Catholic. So what Henry VIII did is he decided, I want a new Bible done. I want an official Bible done. And we're going to get one Bible, and we're going to be able to reunite the nation. Now, essentially, that didn't happen, and so it really leads us down to the fact that by the time of James I of England, or that he was James VI of Scotland as well, like 2 centuries of bloodstained war over the Bible had taken place, and it was just not over the Bible; it was over Bible translation. So when James came to the throne. At the suggestion of Puritan leaders, basically Calvinists, they asked that they actually start work on an English translation of the Bible that could be transmitted and given to everybody in England, and that was the very beginning of the start of the King James Bible. So that was January 1st, 1604, is when they started. Now, it was just amazing what they did, and I'm going to save that, how they set about to translate the Bible. I'm going to save that for the next program because we are running out of time today. So remember, you can request a free copy of Gerald Flory's important book, The True History of God's True Church, and you can get that at thetrumpet.com. You can even request one sent to you from there. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.